Welcome to the Immigrant Legal Resource Center's Immigration Issues Explored conference call. My name is Rebecca, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Eric Cohen. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Rebecca, and welcome, and thank you, everyone, for attending today. As Rebecca said, my name is Eric Cohen. I'm the executive director of the ILSC. I'm also an attorney. I've been working with the ILSC since 1988, and I am going to be the moderator, so to speak, of our wonderful call today. I want to thank you all so much for supporting the ILRC. You are the reason why we can do all the great work we do. So thanks to all of you. As Rebecca said, this call is being recorded to be shared later, and you all can get can download it as well so that you can listen to it a second time or a third time or share it with your friends. First, before we start, I do want to say a few words about the ILRC's work, and then I want to introduce Sharon Hing and then Bill Hing and set the stage for our talk. So the ILRC's job is to protect immigrants and keep them in the United States together with their families and help them thrive here. We do this by building the capacity in the field of immigration lawyers, pro bono attorneys, and nonprofit organizations so they know how to help immigrants better. We also engage in policy and advocacy work on a national, state, and local level. And we conduct immigrant leadership training, outreach, and education to build the capacity of immigrant communities to advocate on their own behalf. All of you help us do this work. So let's talk about today. As we know, the Trump administration has relentless focus on dismantling our immigration system, including increasing mass detention, family separation, and changes to asylum policies. The Trump administration has been able to fast-track immigration-related policy changes because of immigration policy decisions made by previous administrations. Last month, we had a telebriefing where we discussed some actions and activities from previous administrations, from Carter to Obama, that have helped to lead us to where we are now and help lead Donald Trump to where he's taken the immigration debate. The essential point of last month's call was that the six presidents before Trump were also guilty of many horrific policies directly and negatively impacting immigrants in unfair and previously unseen ways. These included Ronald Reagan's efforts to increase mass incarceration and to push back against Central American asylum cases during the 1980s, when asylum was more important than ever because of the civil wars and terror in Central America, and to George H.W. Bush's reluctance to assist students pushing for reforms during Tiananmen Square in China, to President Clinton's draconian changes to the immigration laws in 1996 that paved the way for the accelerated detentions and deportations and cruel tearing apart of families that is happening today. And then to George W. Bush's push to increase immigration raids and deportations and his administration's racist and Islamophobic treatment of Muslim immigrants. All the way to President Obama, who became the, quote, deporter-in-chief because of the record number of deportations that he was responsible for. So what we outlined in the call last month was that these six presidents helped set the table for Donald Trump, who is the biggest racist and xenophobe of them all. To lead this discussion about Trump and his dastardly policies, we are so lucky to have Sharon Hing and Professor Bill Ong Hing. Sharon started the ILRC in 2015. She serves as the legal program collaboration manager for the ILRC, and she manages initiatives to maximize the collective and collaborative work of our attorneys. Sharon contributes to the ILRC's legal technical assistance resources, including writing and updating practice advisories and manuals. She was a litigation associate at Koblenz, Patch, Duffy & Bass, LLP, and she clerked for the Honorable Harry Pregerson of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Sharon received her law degree from UCLA School of Law, with a specialization in critical race studies and concentration in the Epstein Program in Public Interest Law and Policy. She also served as editor-in-chief of the Asian Pacific American Law Journal. Bill Hing is the founder of the Immigrant Legal Resource Center and continues to volunteer as its general counsel and board member. He is a professor of law and migration studies at the University of San Francisco and serves as the director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic. He is also professor emeritus at University of California, Davis School of Law. He is the author of numerous academic and practice-oriented books and articles on immigration policy and community lawyering. And his most recent book, which is right on point, is called American Presidents, Deportations, and Human Rights Violations from Carter to Trump, published in January of 2019. It's a must-read. Professor Hing was co-counsel in the precedent-setting Supreme Court asylum case, INS versus Cardoza Fonseca, in 1987. And as I always introduce Bill, perhaps most importantly, Bill has been a teacher and mentor to hundreds of immigration attorneys, including myself. So welcome, Bill and Sharon. Thank you for participating today. And I want to start off with a question to Bill. So the Trump, as we know, the Trump administration has been very focused on restricting immigration to this country. One example that goes largely unnoticed is the Trump administration's recent limitation to the number of refugees to the United States. Their limitation would allow 18,000 this year. That's a historic low rate, as the last year of the Obama administration allowed 115,000 refugees. And so the question to Bill is just kind of a big, broad question. What's driving this restriction? Is it to play to Trump's base to fulfill the election promise, or what else might be driving it, or is that it?
Well, you know, none of us really know what goes through that man's mind, but this, as you say, historic low for refugee numbers set aside is, you could say that it's a manifestation of two things that he talked about during his campaign and soon after he took office. But during the campaign, he was very, very critical of the fact that the Obama administration had announced that it was going to allow in thousands of Syrian refugees to the United States. And Trump really complained about that. And all along, of course, he complained about too many Muslims entering the United States. And as we know, as soon as he took office, within a few days, he instituted the first version of the Muslim ban, and eventually his third iteration of that was upheld by the Supreme Court. But also he continued to just really, impose restrictions on refugees that even under the Obama administration had been allotted for the first year of Trump's office. And so, yeah, I definitely think that what he's doing is he's fulfilling a campaign promise to reduce the number of refugees. And it falls right into the title of this call. It's a dastardly policy because, as I'm sure people listening on this call know, the number of displaced persons around the world has increased, and it's increasing, and the United States owes a moral, not just a legal, but a moral obligation to refugees of the world. Thanks.
Thanks. So we don't really know why, but certainly part of it is an election promise. And maybe part of it is trying to, as you insinuate, undo what Obama did, as many of his policies try to do. Could that be part of it too?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it, Eric, because Obama was pretty consistent with other presidents in terms of the number of refugees that he allotted. And listeners should realize that this is one power that the president does have. Every year, the president gets to set how many refugees can enter the United States from abroad and from which parts of the world. Now, that's in contrast to asylum. And asylum is for somebody who makes it to the country either surreptitiously or who overstays a visa and then applies for protection after they get here. But a refugee is somebody who applies for refugee status from abroad. And as you said in your introduction, this is the lowest ever. If Jimmy Carter had done this, this is on the heels of the 1980 Refugee Act. If Jimmy Carter had such a low allotment, we wouldn't have the Vietnamese and the Cambodian and Laotian communities that we know today in the United States. And all along, people who have fled communist regimes, people who fled Eastern Europe, it's because of the refugee programs that these vital members of the United States communities today were able to enter the United States. So, yeah, he definitely is trying to change the course of who enters the United States, and this is one way that he's doing it.
Okay, thank you. So I wanted to turn to Sharon for a few minutes and talk about Trump's dastardly policies kind of from an overview perspective. The administration's attacks on immigration law have been relentless, and on immigrants and immigration have been relentless. Sharon, what has the ILRC done to analyze what's been happening, and how do we make sense of all this? How do we keep track of it all?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. So as I'm sure all of you recognize, it feels like every day there's a new assault against the immigrant community. It can often feel overwhelming and confusing. And so as a staff over a year ago, we sat down and analyzed exactly how the Trump administration was attacking immigrant communities. And so we did that first just by listing the myriad attacks, and then we started categorizing them. And we realized that six major categories or themes started to come up. And so we continue to catalog the attacks that arise every day under this framework. So those strategies are the first, preventing entry. The second is preventing status. The third is taking away status. The fourth is eliminating due process. The fifth is detention, deportation, and terror. And then the sixth is future threats. So these are ones either that we could imagine happening or the ones that have literally been threatened upon the community. So let me just go over a couple of these categories just so that I can illustrate what we mean through a few examples. So the first one, preventing entry. This really involves the legal and literal barriers the administration is erecting to keep people from entering the country. So one example of this is extreme vetting. And in 2017, the Trump administration introduced what really is an opaque, arbitrary, and inconsistent process to screen immigrants and visitors that's supposed to determine whether an individual possesses values that are supposedly acceptable for entry, and this has led to inexplicable delays in visa processing. This also requires individuals to be subjected to enhanced collection and review of biometric and biographical data, and heightened security overall. Another example of this would be dismantling of the country's asylum system. So there have been myriad experimental policy changes that have made it even more difficult to apply for asylum, and the Trump administration's agreements with Central American countries that require migrants to seek protections in those countries first effectively cut off access to the American asylum system. So when we look at the second category, which is preventing status, this can be understood as policy and legal changes that make it more difficult to access various forms of immigration relief. And so you can think of this as a quote-unquote invisible wall that is being erected. So, for example, as many of you are aware, the new public charge rules will make it more difficult for especially vulnerable immigrants to apply to enter the U.S. or to adjust status to get a green card. Although last Friday the public charge rule was blocked by several judges, the administration will certainly appeal these decisions, And despite the public charge rule not yet being in place, many immigrants have already dropped their benefits. Another example of preventing status is through increased processing times and backlogs. These extreme backlogs have grown at a record pace and now exceeds 1 million cases. These ballooning processing times leave families in financial distress and expose vulnerable immigrants to even more danger. And so those are just a couple of ways in which we've thought about what's been going on.
That's great, Sharon. And just a point on the increased processing times and backlogs. We recently testified in front of Congress about just the backlogs around naturalization, which have grown to a record amount, going from about a six-month wait to now in many jurisdictions to about a two-year wait. There's about 750,000 people who have waited over 6 months in the United States. So, the backlogs are really wreaking havoc. So we've gone over the preventing status and the preventing entry. Let's take a couple more of these, Sharon, if we could. Maybe you could talk about a couple of these other categories, like the taking away status, eliminating due process, and detention, deportation, and terror, and give some examples of those for the listeners.
Yeah, and I think another example with regards to the third strategy, taking away status, something that doesn't often get as much attention is the Trump administration has increased resources dedicated to stripping citizenship from naturalized citizens. The Open Society Justice Initiative published a comprehensive report on denaturalization efforts by the administration, and it found that in comparison to previous administrations, denaturalizations increased significantly during the Trump administration's first 2 years, with nearly three times as many civil denaturalizations filed than the average over the previous eight administrations. So I think if that's just in the numbers, and then if we look at specifically who is being attacked with this strategy, there's a significant correlation between the countries of origin most commonly represented in denaturalization cases, so those include Mexico, Haiti, Nigeria, and the countries that President Trump has publicly demeaned. So the practice is not only arbitrary, but it's over-inclusive, and it applies unequally based on national origin. And so, as mentioned earlier, we really can only see this as a proxy for targets based on race, ethnicity, and religion. Another example, which also has been in the news, is ending temporary protected status for many of the major countries that participate in this program: El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nepal, Nicaragua, Sudan, and limiting it for Syrians, Yemenis, and Somalis. And then if we look at the eliminating due process strategy, this one makes it extremely more difficult or cuts off altogether immigrants' ability to receive fair treatment through the adjudication of their cases. So these are all the attacks for those who are already in the country and are just trying to seek relief. For example, there has been a dramatic rise in courthouse arrests. The expansion of ICE arrests in courthouses has created a chilling effect on local immigrant communities and really discouraged them from seeking justice. In 2018, ACLU and the National Immigrant Women's Advocacy Project did an extensive survey of judges and law enforcement officers, and 54% of the judges surveyed reported that they had court cases interrupted because an immigrant crime survivor's fear of coming to court, which is as opposed to 43% of judges reporting this effect in 2016. Another way the administration is cutting off due process is through the increased use of video conferencing in immigration hearings. So many of you may know that this is now a more popular way to have immigrants show up for their hearings. Between 2015 and 2017, there has been a 185% increase in the use of video teleconferences for detained immigrants to appear at their deportation hearings. So these are really critical and important hearings for these individuals, but they no longer appear in person. And so what ends up happening is that these immigrants end up giving up more quickly and it leads to an increase in deportations. And then finally, the biggest category when we started grouping all of these attacks really is the detention, deportation, and terror category, which includes all of the administration's blatant attempts to instill fear in the immigrant community. These include the quote-unquote silent raids at routine immigration check-ins, and then also, if we go back to public charge, those changes, just the announcements of them, have already scared families from accessing legal and necessary health care services. And then just looking forward, we're always analyzing and preparing for possible future threats. Unfortunately, many of them have come to pass. And a couple that look like they're on the horizon are changes to the fee waivers, which are an essential tool for low-income immigrants to apply for relief. Some of the proposed new rules may no longer allow a person to use the receipt of public benefits to prove they can't afford to pay for their filing fees. And this really is the most common and easiest way to request a fee waiver, and this would be essentially cutting off access to that. So that's just one example of something that we see on the horizon, and is something that the ILRC is doing a lot to prepare ourselves and the immigrant rights community to address. Those are just some quick examples, unfortunately, of many, many, many we've collected.
A lot of quick examples. And just a couple of points about all those. The ILRC and our allied organizations are working on every one of these. Just a couple of examples of that. The proposed changes to fee waivers, that's really dastardly. For instance, in the naturalization context, which Trump obviously doesn't want more people to naturalize, we run the New Americans campaign, which has helped well over 420,000 people apply for naturalization, and about 40% of those people are low income and are relying on the fee waiver. And not only, as Sharon said, is it going to be more difficult to get, there are even proposals in this administration to eliminate it altogether. So what would happen is they would eliminate the opportunity for poor people to become naturalized. And so we've been working a lot on in Washington, D.C., and in making sure that there are good comments to the proposed regulations, and making sure that members of Congress know about this and have it on their radar so they can push back around it. So as you can tell, there are a lot of different things here. Another interesting one is the rise in courthouse arrests that Sharon mentioned, and we have a team of folks who are working on trying to get trying to make sure that ICE can't go into the courthouses in California and other places. So that's something else that we've been working on. But as you can tell, and as Sharon had said, you know, Trump seems to be getting his wall, maybe not a concrete cement wall, but brick by brick, an invisible wall, by denying more people green cards and more people naturalization and denying more asylum and deporting so many more people and tearing apart families. So I'd like to ask Bill, you know, how do we make sense of the assault on immigrants' rights? And, you know, and what actors or agents are influencing this agenda, this anti-immigrant agenda? What do you think about all that?
Well, you know, Eric, just even sitting back and listening to this and being reminded me of what's going on, it's this assault is something that he promised. As we all know, some of the first words that he uttered out of his mouth on the infamous day that he announced that he was running for the president was an assault on Mexican immigrants. And he kept that assault on immigrant rhetoric up throughout his campaign, and he's done that continuously during his presidency. A lot of it, I think, does have to do with his own racial bias, and a lot of it, I believe he truly feels, and some of the numbers bear this out, that his success in the campaign in 2016, the election, is very much attributable to an anti-immigrant group of voters that supported him. And so I believe that he's keeping up this assault because of his base. And he's coming up with new things, it seems like, at least weekly, if not daily. And in terms of the actors or agents that are influencing him or influencing much of the anti-immigrant agenda, of course, the news often reports about Stephen Miller, who has apparently definitely has the ear of the president, but also a player who surfaces over and over again every few months is Kris Kobach, who is a former law professor, former Secretary of State in Kansas, the author of Arizona's SB 1070, the author of Alabama's HB 56, all these terrible state anti-immigrant laws. He was the co-chair of President Bush, President Trump's committee that was formed to ferret out so-called illegal voters who voted in the 2016 campaign, and that commission lasted, I think, for like 2 months before they realized that there was nothing to be found. But Kris Kobach is seen in and out of the White House still. And he's been trying to get appointed to be the Secretary of Homeland Security. And I'm not sure if he's going to be able to jockey himself into that position. So he definitely is still a player and influencing. And you could also go back to Trump's very first Secretary of Homeland Security, who was General John Kelly, who later became the White House Chief of Staff. John Kelly did exactly what Trump wanted in the first several months of the presidency. He was behind implementing the Muslim ban. He was behind announcements that there were going to be raids. He was behind no further extensions of people who were under order of supervision or prosecutorial discretion under the Obama administration, terminating all that. Mr. Trump has had a lot of very, very influential folks who have pushed him or at least followed his orders or put his orders into some type of form that that translates into regulations.
Yeah, thanks. And I guess we should give our due here to two other dastardly actors. One that Bill could probably talk about for a minute, the Center for Immigration Studies, which seems to have been some of the movement thinkers behind the anti-immigrant policies. And the other is, from my understanding, that a lot of Department of Homeland Security employees, veteran employees who have been waiting for a moment like this at the border, as part of the Citizenship and Immigration Service, there's a minority of employees that have been waiting for the opportunity to give their anti-immigrant perspective on how to change things. But I don't know what you feel about those two bodies as well, Bill.
That's a good point, Eric. Before 2016, the ICE Union had never, neither the ICE Union nor the Border Patrol Union, which are two separate unions, had never before endorsed a presidential candidate, but both of them endorsed Donald Trump in the 2016 election. Now keep this in mind that, when President Obama announced the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, he was actually sued by the ICE Union. That lawsuit was thrown out of court on the grounds that they didn't have standing, and also the federal judge in that case said, he's your boss, you got to do what your boss tells you. So it tells you that, yeah, there is a certain segment of ICE employees who felt constrained by Obama and they felt liberated after Mr. Trump was elected. And as our old friend Mark Silverman, who was on the Howard Hughes staff for a few decades, the way he put it, it was basically like releasing Doberman ICE agents to just go out and do whatever the heck they wanted to. And I think you see that manifested in very random types of arrests that occur in different parts of the country. There's so much power that an individual ICE director in a certain district has to set the tone for what's going on in that particular district. And they basically kind of do whatever they want to, knowing under the Trump administration that they won't be reprimanded for stepping out of line. Whereas under the Obama administration, if they actually, for example, put an end to, pretty much put an end to gun-toting raids, and they didn't permit that kind of thing. But under the new administration, if there was a raid of a factory and weapons were displayed, I'm sure they would not be criticized by Washington.
Thanks. So let's move on to a couple of policy questions that Sharon had brought up and delve a little more into them. We want to talk about a little bit about asylum and a little bit about public charge and maybe a little bit about the enforcement ramp up. But Bill, to you, let's first talk about what the Trump administration is doing to deter, or some would say effectively almost eliminate, asylum. Can you elaborate on how the administration is fundamentally changing the asylum process?
You know, the as you said at the outset, Ronald Reagan was not that great on asylum for Central Americans, particularly Guatemalans and El Salvadorans. Very low approval rate. Sometimes Border Patrol forgot to tell people they arrested along the southwest border that there was such a thing as asylum, and there were lawsuits over that. Well, the Trump administration has probably come up with a million more strategies to deter especially Central American and Mexican asylum seekers, I just never believed in my lifetime I would see such things happening. For example, the family separation issue that we saw the spring and summer of 2018, when they just blatantly and indiscriminately separated parents from their children that were approaching the border. Recently, the so-called Migration Protection Protocol, which is the Remain in Mexico policy, which has now required close to 50,000 asylum seekers to wait on the Mexican side of the border, even though most of them have passed credible fear screening. They have to wait for their turn to be called back in for an immigration hearing. Then these crazy agreements that the Trump administration has strong-armed all four countries, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and Mexico, into agreeing that if somebody comes through their country first, that they've got to entertain an application for asylum. So this so-called third country requirement that the Trump administration is imposing states that if you cannot apply for asylum in the United States, if you first pass through a third country, you have to apply there first and then show that you've been denied before you can apply for asylum in the United States. And so it's that. It's Attorney General decisions. Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued a decision, matter of AB, a little bit more than a year ago that tries to limit asylum for individuals who are claiming that they are victims of domestic violence or gang violence, trying to cut back on that. And then Attorney General William Barr issued a decision, matter of LEA, that purports to hold that the family is not considered a social group
for purposes of asylum, and particular social group is one of the main bases for asylum for people that are fleeing these countries. And so they've tried everything. They're basically, to use a cliche, they're trying every trick in the book that they can come up with to forestall legitimate refugees from seeking asylum in the United States.
And just quickly, what some of the impact of the Stay and Remain in Mexico program and the third country applying for asylum, third country, is that, I mean, are people going to get asylum in El Salvador?
No, thanks for that follow-up, Eric, and I should have said this. None of those four countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Mexico, have a viable asylum system.
Hello? Oh, Bill, I think we just lost Bill. Sharon, are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, hold that thought, everyone, and maybe we'll jump to the next point and then circle back around the bill. I apologize about that. His phone might have happened to his phone. So let's talk about, Sharon, if we could, a second policy question. Let's talk a little bit about how there's a campaign to build fear, discourage people from coming, from doing things. Is that Bill back on the line? Oh, discourage people from applying for a green card, from applying for naturalization. How does this play out with regards to public charge and this new medical insurance requirement that they just announced like a week ago? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned before, the new public charge rule was blocked by several judges last Friday, which means that the new rules that were planned will not go into effect yet, and they're supposed to go into effect this Tuesday, actually. But it is inevitable that the Trump administration is going to appeal these decisions, and this just means that another judge could allow the programs to move forward in the future. But for now, public charge continues to apply as it has for the past 20 years. Really, the only public benefit programs that currently count as part of public charge are cash aid and long-term institutionalized care paid for by the government. And so what the ILRC really is advising community members is that anyone applying now to go through the green card application process in the United States still qualifies under the old or current policy and not under the new rule, which really just seeks to expand the list of benefit programs that could be considered so that you could be designated as a public charge. And it's also just important to remember that many immigrants are not eligible for the public benefits that may cause a problem in a public charge determination, and their family members' use of benefits will not be counted against them either. In the majority of cases, the best advice we can give is for folks to just keep using the programs to which they're entitled, even if the rule eventually goes into effect. So, as I mentioned, the rule is supposed to go into effect on Tuesday, and it would have established a test to determine whether an immigrant applying to enter the U.S., extend their visa, or convert their temporary immigration status is likely to end up depending on public benefits. In regards to this presidential proclamation that just is hot off the press, it requires anyone applying for an immigrant visa to show that they will have health insurance within the first 30 days of entry. And as you can imagine, it just will specifically harm low-income immigrants. It would deny entry into the U.S. to people seeking family-based immigrant visas and some others if they can't show that they'll be covered by health insurance, or have the financial resources to pay for out-of-pocket health insurance. And also, it will apply to parents of U.S. citizens who cannot show that their health care will not impose a substantial burden on the U.S. health care system. Really, what we see this as a circumvention around inadmissibility laws, and it just all together is terrible, and hopefully none of it will go into effect in the near future.
I'm back on the line too, Eric. Whenever you
okay, thanks. So we'll go back in a second to that asylum stuff. We've just been chatting about public charge. We're assuming that there's going to be a lawsuit around this health insurance issue, and it will be delayed and hopefully never implemented. An immigrant visa, just so you guys don't, for those who don't know, is a green card. So those people trying to get green cards under this proclamation would have to show private health insurance. And just a note about what the ILSC's role has been in this whole public charge debate is that so the way it started was that the administration issued proposed regulations to change the definition, as Sharon was talking about, change the definition of someone who could become a public charge and thus exclude lots and lots of people from obtaining their green cards, all low-income people, of course, or mostly low-income. And we led the charge to come out with some really good comments to those regulations. We also have written the only manual and resources, the main resource for practitioners who are figuring out what this public charge rule means. We've done a lot of community-facing materials around public charge because we feel that the biggest threat right now is, as Sharon said, for those immigrants who are fearful of how this public charge rule might in the future impact their future ability to get a green card. And, you know, if they have kids on benefits, so what they're doing, a lot of them, we've heard anecdotally, is these parents are taking their U.S. citizen kids off of Medi-Cal and off of food stamps. These are poverty programs. They're obviously very necessary for these kids. And so we are producing a lot of community-facing materials and going on the ethnic media, trying to discourage families from doing that because it's still okay to have their kids on those programs. So thanks, Sharon. And maybe, Bill, we could just hop back to you. You were talking about how those countries, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico, don't really have viable asylum programs.
Yeah, I'll be quick so that you can move on. Exactly. It's ridiculous that those countries have been strong-armed into accepting applications because all four, but especially the Northern Triangle countries of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, are three of the most violent countries in the world. And to expect people to seek safe harbor in countries of extreme violence is just mind-blowing. And as I was saying before I got cut off, those countries do not have viable asylum systems. Mexico is perhaps the most advanced, but they only have three asylum offices for the entire country. And the other countries just aren't even capable of handling asylum applications, much less are they appropriate. And the Remain in Mexico policy, part of the big problem with that is access to counsel. I mean, there's always a problem with access to counsel, even for those who make it to the United States. So can you imagine trying to find an attorney if you are stuck in Mexico to help you with your asylum claim in the United States? And even the converse, let's say you do have an attorney. Can you imagine that volunteer attorney usually preparing you when you're not in the country to be prepared, and the expense and the inconvenience of having to go, if you had the time to represent somebody who's in Tijuana or in Nogales or in on the other side of El Paso, it's impossible to do that. And yes, there are lawsuits that are being filed on these issues, but in the meantime, there's so much damage. Asylum applications are being denied every day by those folks who show up at their hearings and they can't get attorneys or adequate representation.
Yeah, it sounds like to ask him to a Honduran to apply for asylum in Guatemala is kind of asking someone to jump from the frying pan to the fire. Not sure how helpful that is. So let's move on quickly a little bit to thanks for that, Bill and Sharon, to the increased immigration enforcement that's been happening under the Trump administration, and a little bit about the resistance to that. For Bill, you know, can you talk about a little bit about what Trump is doing around detention right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, there, as some of your listeners may know, there's actually a bed mandate that I think it's 42,000 now, that Congress in its wisdom, the Republican-led Congress before last year, passed legislation that makes it that ICE has to have at least 40-something thousand people in detention every night. And the truth is that they have more than 50,000, so they don't have any problem meeting that. And so it's more difficult now to get bail if you're in detention. And the detention centers have been expanded. And related to that is the Trump administration's attempt to do away with the Flores settlement agreement. The Flores settlement agreement is 20 years old. It rules, it's an agreement over the conditions and the length of time that minors can be detained by ICE. And the Trump administration, on its own proposed regulations that would essentially allow them to hold these children with their families indefinitely, but fortunately, the judge who has jurisdiction over the Flores case, Judge Dolly G in Los Angeles, a few weeks ago ruled that those proposed regulations were not legal. But it's mass detention throughout the country and increased focus on detention to try to make it difficult for people who might have attorneys to be represented. As Sharon said earlier, the increased use of these video hearings makes deportation more likely, and detention is a strategy that's being implemented by the Trump administration, multifold.
Yeah, so some of the there are obvious problems with detention that you mentioned. One is someone's incarcerated, and that's awful. Also, it's harder to get an attorney and to have that attorney represent you in a vigorous fashion. Is that true too?
That's absolutely true. It's virtually impossible to have. They usually have these detention centers in places that are inaccessible. And to make matters worse, the federal government contracts with private prison companies who make millions and millions of dollars every year having detention contracts with ICE. The biggest groups are Geo Group and a company that is now called CoreCivic. And fortunately, the ILRC actually is behind recent successful state legislation in California, a piece of legislation called AB 32 that the governor just signed last Thursday, I think, that prevents private prison companies from doing business in California. And that includes, it prevents them from contracting with ICE to detain people here in California. So I'm so proud of the ILRC for taking up that issue.
Yeah, it was a hard-fought battle, and Newsom did sign it last Friday, I think, but late last week. Mm-hmm. And it's an opportunity for people to hopefully get bonded out better, quicker, and be represented, be reunited with their families, go back to work if they're working here, et cetera. And it's something that the ILRC... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to mention one other thing on the representation front. Fortunately, there are different counties and the state that have stepped up with monies for legal services programs to hire additional attorneys to do removal defense. And it was the ILRC that lobbied San Francisco, that lobbied Santa Clara, that lobbied San Mateo, that lobbied the state of California to come up with money to distribute to community-based organizations to hire more immigration attorneys for removal defense. And that's something definitely to the credit of ILRC staff.
Yeah, no, thanks for mentioning that, Bill. And we worked with a big coalition in all those areas as well, but the ILRC was very involved in providing a lot of the legal expertise and a lot of the experiential work. But we had great coalitions both statewide and locally. And now we're working on trying to spread the word to other counties and other states. Because this idea that Bill was talking about, getting people represented, is key, and we need to continue to build the capacity of those people, those lawyers, often younger lawyers and or volunteer lawyers that need help in learning about asylum and other forms of relief. So we only have about 5 minutes, and I wanted to open it up to any questions for the audience. So, Rebecca, if you have the opportunity, if anyone's asked a question, if not, I'll ask some questions. But anybody in line or everybody, maybe Rebecca, you could remind people how to ask a question, please.
We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star, then one.
Thanks, Rebecca. So while we're waiting to see if anyone has questions, Bill or Sharon, do you want to add anything to what we've already been talking about? Any last words?
Well, I'll jump in. I think that on the public charge issue, and I know that both you and Sharon said this, but I think it was a matter of people that need to feed their family or that need to get medical assistance. Then they need to do it, and they need to worry about the public charge issue on another day, because people should not be putting the health and the well-being of their family aside in the face of this. And they got to have confidence that we're going to be able to pull back on this public charge issue with whatever new administration takes over at some point.
Right. You know, a couple other of Trump's dastardly activities that we didn't get into, we did get into a lot, that I maybe just want to throw out there, and Bill and Sharon can react if they want. One is the fraud tip hotline that they've developed, and another is how much easier it's going to be, or how much more common it's going to be, that they put people in deportation proceedings who are applying for a green card or naturalization, but instead of getting that, they end up in deportation proceedings. Have you guys heard of, you know about those, want to talk about either of those?
Yeah, I can jump in on the fraud tip. Essentially, USCIS has developed a form and a separate unit, actually, that will allow the public to submit pretty much unsubstantiated reports of quote-unquote immigration fraud, and it's just going to continue to cast immigrants as suspect and fundamentally criminal. June 2018, USCIS created the USCIS Fraud Tip Unit, and an interesting note is that it's co-located with ICE, which there has been a lot of conversation and analysis about how USCIS, which really is in the business of helping people get immigration relief, is turning much more into an enforcement agency. So that action, the creation of the unit and this form is just one example of how this is happening.
Yeah, and just to build on that, one of the real fears that we have is that this is a great way to, if you're an employer who has been working with an employee and don't want to pay them, or for some reason the employee is disgruntled about something you did, why not just call the fraud tip hotline, whether or not it's substantiated, we're really concerned about this happening in domestic violence situations where a spouse who has a U.S. citizenship has married someone who's undocumented, and can more easily threaten and hold it over their heads that if they call the police for domestic violence, the U.S. citizen will then call the fraud tip hotline and get them deported. So that's just another example of what this administration's doing. And to Sharon's point, we're actually leading a committee of other organizations in Washington, D.C., that is devised to, it's called Combating How the Citizenship and Immigration Service has Become an Enforcement Agency. So it's devised actually to push back in many ways on this traditional benefits providing agency, the Citizenship and Immigration Service, and how that's become more and more of an enforcement agency, especially with this character, Ken Cuccinelli, who is now kind of Trump's lapdog on anti-immigrant policies. He's running that agency now. So thank you all, and thank you especially to Bill and Sharon for participating today. I thank all of you for listening, and especially for being supporters of the ILRC. It's because of you that we're allowed to not only put on these programs, but obviously to do all the work that we do on a daily basis to help immigrants and to push back against Trump's dastardly policies. So we do have one more in the series coming up on naturalization and citizenship and where that's going, and really, really want to once again thank you all for listening and thank Bill and Sharon for participating. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.